Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Robert Fantina, who is the author of three wonderful books. One is called Desertion and the American Soldier. Another is a work of fiction called Look Not Unto the Morrow. And the third forthcoming book is called Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. Bob Fantina, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
The first book I read by you, which came out several years ago now, I guess, was called Desertion and the American Soldier, and looked at the phenomenon of desertion from the U.S. military going back to before there was a United States, the War of Independence. What did you discover about desertion? Has it always been the same? Have things been changing in this regard?
Well, David, there are many similarities from the American Revolution right to the Iraqi occupation. Often there was disagreement with the reason for the war. That was a very common reason throughout most of the wars that I looked at throughout the U.S. history. Even the American Revolution, while there seems to be a myth that all Americans were very much interested in gaining independence, all the colonists, what it turns out when you look at the actual facts is that about a third supported independence, about another third were loyal to the king, and the remaining third kind of went both ways. So there wasn't that tremendous amount of enthusiasm throughout the entire populace. Also, during that time, the cruelty to the soldiers by the U.S. government was astounding, and that is another component that has lasted up until today.
Tell the listeners what you told your readers in the book about George Washington's desired policies toward deserters.
Well, he wanted to... The policies toward deserters were extremely cruel. They included whipping, lashing, branding on the face, all kinds of different really cruel and inhumane treatments. He wanted to make them even more severe, but Congress balked at that because there really wasn't much difference between the normal treatment of the soldiers and treatment of deserters. The treatment of soldiers was so bad anyway.
As I recall, you wrote that that Washington wanted to go up from 100 lashes to 500 lashes as punishment, and considered simply hard labor for a punishment, but there wouldn't have been enough difference between hard labor and ordinary participation in the war.
Exactly. The hard labor as a punishment wasn't a punishment because that's what it wasn't a punishment for deserters because that's what regular soldiers had to endure anyway.
Has this changed completely now that all the non-soldiering work has been outsourced to contractors and the military member's job is purely and simply to kill? Is the hard labor gone?
No, there's still hard labor involved in any kind of war activity. There's certainly some outsourcing to private companies, but American soldiers still suffer greatly just by being in the military. One of the other things that is striking and has been a part of the U.S. military from the beginning is the deprivation of basic human rights, basic rights that a soldier is supposed to be fighting for other people. They themselves are deprived of right to assembly, right to free speech. These are things that are deprived of U.S. soldiers. As soon as they sign on the dotted line to join the military or when they're conscripted, these rights are removed from them.
We call it a volunteer army, but most things you volunteer for, you can unvolunteer from. That's not the case here.
Exactly. When a soldier volunteers, they volunteer for a certain period of time, but even that is not respected by the government. There's the stop-loss policy, which means that the U.S. military can keep a soldier in the military for as long as the military chooses, regardless of what agreements were made initially with that soldier. This is just one of the areas where the military does not need to keep its commitments. Soldiers are sometimes, they sometimes enlist with a promise that they will remain stateside, for example, or that they will be given certain jobs and a career path in the military. The U.S. military does not have to respect any of that, and more often than not, doesn't.
And so looking at the trends in desertion over the decades and centuries from the War for Independence to now, is the primary cause the hardship and suffering? Is it the deprivation of basic rights? Is it disagreement with the alleged cause of the war? What's causing most of the desertion, and how much desertion is there?
Well, there's a lot of desertion. It has fluctuated with each war and in peacetime. But the reasons that you've mentioned, David, the harsh conditions, disagreement with war, stop-loss policy, all these are part of it. Even today, so many soldiers' families have to live in poverty because the soldiers receive so little pay. And this is something that has been a problem since the beginning. Desertion was rampant in the early wars of the United States because soldiers were often given or promised bonuses for enlistment, and many of them were living in extreme poverty, and that promised bonus would be a big help to their family. They enlisted, and then the bonus was never paid. So they had to leave the army to go back to work to earn money for their families. Now, even today, we hear about the wonderful GI benefits for veterans. But when we look at those, one soldier I spoke to who deserted from the military during the Iraqi war said that the benefits, the educational benefits, would only pay for 1 year of the college program he wanted to take. So there is this myth that the government takes care of its veterans, and it's just not true.
Clearly not. We spend over half of our discretionary spending each year through the public funding by our government on wars and the military, but there seems to be a priority towards funding big shiny weapons over funding soldiers and veterans. And in fact, we get appeals in the mail every day to donate, to give our used clothing and books and help veterans as they supposedly helped us. And I wonder if that isn't in some form desirable by certain parties, that there be that involvement by the public in helping the troops and reminding the public thereby that supposedly the troops somehow helped them.
I think that's definitely a part of it. It gives people who are staying in the comfort of their homes and who put a flag on the back of their car with the caption, "Support the troops," it makes them feel good. Oh, I'm donating my used clothing to the Veterans Association or something. But as you mentioned, so much money goes to buying the weaponry. And you'll recall that just a few years ago, there was an expose with the Walter Reed Medical Center, which at the time was the United States' premier medical facility for veterans. And the shocking, horrific conditions, the neglect, the filth that was a part of the suffering veterans' living conditions became public. This is how veterans are treated after they have attempted to serve the country in whatever misguided or dishonest effort the U.S. government has made. Soldiers go in there in good faith, trying to do something constructive. They're injured seriously, and then the treatment for them when they get out is terrible. I recorded in the desertion book about one soldier who had lost a kidney in a roadside bombing in Iraq. He was recuperating in his car because the government was charging him for a reenlistment bonus that they said he didn't fulfill his part of the bargain. He reenlisted, he was injured, discharged due to the injury, and then they were dunning him for this bonus that he had been paid. That impacted his credit rating. He couldn't get an apartment. This is how the government treats the veterans.
So give us some numbers. How many members of the U.S. military have deserted during the so-called global war on terrorism, and how do those desertion rates compare with past eras, including time periods when there was a draft and there was not something that went by the name the volunteer army?
In the last several years, since the start of really the Iraqi war, there have been probably close to 20,000 desertions. Now, it's hard to actually put a number on it because desertion is defined in a few different ways. A soldier is just considered absent without official leave for 30 days, and then after that point, they're considered a deserter. But it's close to 20,000 at this point. This is actually comparable with the most recent draft, period of draft, that was during the Vietnam era. The desertion rate during Vietnam wasn't as high as it might be expected, but draft evasion was extremely high. Many, many young Americans who were eligible for the draft moved to Canada to avoid the draft. It was more difficult to desert once a soldier got to Vietnam because there was really no place for him to go. And I say him because at that time it was mostly men. But the desertion rate has stayed in most wars fairly constant, and it is significant. In the earlier wars, when George Washington was general, he said at one point that he would have to send half of the remaining military out to get the other half, because desertion was so high at that time.
When people hear the word desertion, that I think there's usually a negative connotation of running away from one's duty, and a different connotation from that accompanying, for example, the phrase conscientious objection or the phrase resistance. And there have certainly been resistors and conscientious objectors. How do those statistics factor into to that of desertion?
Conscientious objectors, the government is very, very hesitant to give anyone the designation conscientious objector. People who have a long history of religious opposition to any war, who have demonstrated pacifism in their attitudes, their writings, and so on, are routinely denied the designation of conscientious objector. Those who resist, as far as the numbers of resistors, is great. It's been greater during the time of draft, because right now it's a poverty draft, of course, generally referred to. But the numbers are extremely high in any time when there's a draft. People leaving the country. This wasn't just during the Vietnam era, although it's often focused on that. You also mentioned, David, the negative connotation of desertion. And we grow up in the United States with the concept that deserters are either traitors or cowards or both. And the research that I've done, the interviews that I've done with men who have deserted from the military, from the U.S. military, indicate that is a complete lie, that these are men of great courage and conviction and principle, and I have tremendous respect for them all.
In fact, it seems to be largely a problem of having thought that when soldiers blindly obey, they're not inclined to desert. And that, in fact, when they start thinking about what the reasons are for the war, the supposed reasons and the actual reasons, that they tend to desert, which would seem to be an overabundance of thoughtfulness as opposed to a lack of courage.
Yeah, absolutely, that is so correct. They have, many times they enlist or in periods of draft, they go into war feeling that they are protecting American freedom or protecting freedom from someone else, and then they get there and they see what's actually happening. And this causes a large number of desertions. People see that they are not accomplishing good for anybody. They are risking their own lives and risking other people's lives for no reason, no high principle, whatever, and they decide, enough, I'm not going to do this anymore, and they desert. And desertion from the U.S. military could theoretically cause execution, and has over the years, but even soldiers deserting today face execution as a possible penalty. That has not happened in a number of years. But it just indicates the amount of courage that it takes to walk away and say no.
You mentioned that one of the objections that soldiers have to remaining in the military is the lack, the stripping away of the rights for which they are supposedly fighting. And of course, during times of war like the present one, the rest of us have our rights stripped away as well, despite the claims that the wars are to protect those very rights. But you printed in the book a list of 11 demands that someone had come up with back in 1903, many of which still not met in terms of rights that soldiers ought to have while participating in the military, including the right to quit and including, and I quote, abolition of military salutes and all other imbecile and servile practices, and so forth. And the picture it paints for me when you go through this list is no longer the military. I mean, how are you going to get people to blindly, thoughtlessly go and kill foreigners, endangering their own country in the process, accelerating the concentration of wealth towards the profiteers. If you take away all of the routines of conditioning and blind obedience and the entrapment of the soldiers in the military, what's going to be left?
Well, I think there's nothing left, and that is not a bad thing. If soldiers are not motivated to go to war, perhaps that would change the way that international conflicts are handled. That list of items that still have not been implemented include things like equal housing, equal food, basic human rights that people are entitled to but that they're deprived of once they become U.S. soldiers.
I can't say I disagree, but of course the military understands as well as you and I, and so it's going to mean having a movement strong enough to end war, to have a movement strong enough to impose these reforms on the military, I'm afraid. But I want to talk, before I go on too long, about this incredible novel that you've written called Look Not Unto the Morrow, which takes a handful of characters from the period of the Vietnam War, or what in Vietnam is called the American War, and really lays out the issues of the debate within U.S. society, of the conduct of the military during the war, of opposition to the war and the development of the peace movement and disagreements within that movement, and does so through a fictional narrative that I think is more powerful than would have been a nonfiction account. Why did you choose to go with fiction in this attempt?
I think, David, there are so many stories, so countless stories of soldiers and the suffering that they have endured as a result of the Vietnam War, as the characters in the book preparing for the war, actually being there and then coming home. And lots of them have very eloquently told their stories. I wanted to combine a few stories together and present, as you said, an overall picture of how war affects people. It's not just the soldier who goes to war. It's not just the victims that he kills. There are so many people who are negatively impacted by war. And once a soldier comes home from war, he or she is unable to turn off being a soldier. I've heard that the U.S. government breaks a man to make a soldier. Other governments teach a man how to be a soldier. That's a significant, I think, difference, and one that I hope I portrayed in this novel. One of the reasons that I wanted to write the novel, a few years ago, I guess 5 years ago now, George Bush commented when he was talking to soldiers in Afghanistan that he wished he were one of them, that it must be very romantic and exciting to be there facing danger and so on. Well, it's not exciting and romantic. It's terrifying and deadly and horrifying in countless ways. And when an American president is saying that it's romantic and exciting, we have a serious problem. So I think in the book, I tried very hard to portray it as horrifying and terrifying and extremely damaging to all people involved.
George W. Bush, who, of course, when he had the opportunity to go to Vietnam, got himself into the Guard and deserted, went AWOL even from that service, as we call it. So it's hard to take his claims too seriously. But this book, Look Not Unto the Morrow, tells the story of a young man who is rather inattentive, uninformed, doesn't quite grasp what war is until he's in the middle of it, and then grasps exactly what it is. And a young woman in love with him, his girlfriend, who similarly doesn't really start to care about the world until her loved one is part of the war. And my hope, of course, in reading this very well-told story is that some young people are going to read it and wake up before it's too late, wake up before they're in the middle of hell. Is this part of your motivation in writing this kind of account?
Absolutely. If I can prevent someone from looking at the glamour of a recruitment poster, and if I can prevent someone from paying attention to the lies that a recruiter tells him or her, and if I can prevent someone from taking the step that my protagonist in the book took, which led him into an abyss of hell, then I will have accomplished something with the book. I think young people often are wrapped up in their own activities, their own, you know, they're starting college, they're in relationships, they're looking to their future, and they don't pay a lot of attention to what's going on. So if they can pick up this novel, which I hope is also entertaining as well as informative, and learn a little bit more and start to think a little bit more, then I think I will have accomplished something and hopefully something positive for the people who read it.
The other book that you have coming out shortly, as I understand, is actually a thorough history of U.S. wars from the beginning to the present day, called Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. And the periods are broken into three overarching themes of Manifest Destiny, taking us up to 1898, and A New World Power, bringing us up to 1953, and then 1954 to the present, which you label Fighting Invented Enemies. Is that is that a change? Did we used to have real enemies and now we have invented ones?
No, I think it's just our perception. I think people are more aware of invented enemies. At some point, there have probably been some real enemies, but U.S. foreign policy has always been based on what is best for the economy, what is best for U.S. business, and what corporate America will best how it will best benefit. And in the 50s, of course, we had the Red Scare. And then after the Cold War, the U.S. looked for something and finally found it in the so-called War on Terror, which is so vague and nebulous, I don't even know what it means. But people are able to look at the Muslim religion as the enemy now and whatever else the government chooses to portray. But if you look back, as I have done in this book, at U.S. foreign policy, not only in time of war, but time of peace, the goal of U.S. foreign policy has been to foster and further and benefit the corporate world, the U.S. corporate world. It's really, some of my research was actually very shocking to me. It was just horrifying, the lengths that the U.S. has gone to, especially during wartime, to benefit the corporate bottom line.
It's a remarkable effort that you've gone through an entire history of major U.S. war operations, and they seem to be more alike than different, going back for a couple of centuries. You know, there's always this idea that certain more recent wars are somehow new and different, that, you know, the Iraq War was the first war we were lied to about. And on the contrary, as I read your history, there seems to be a pattern that we ought to have broken free from long ago, and keep misrecognizing as if it were something new.
Yes, definitely. For each war, I document the stated reasons for the war, what the government said and did to get the enthusiasm of the U.S. people behind the war effort. And then I also dig deeper to find out what the real purpose of the war was. As going back as far as the War of 1812, there was a policy of impressment, whereas soldiers could, the British Navy could board an American ship and take soldiers and force them to serve in the British Navy. Well, this was given as one of the reasons for the War of 1812, the reason the U.S. had to fight Great Britain, when actually the U.S. was looking for increased trade routes and wanted to eliminate the competition that, for the fur trade mainly, that Britain had in Canada. So that was the real reason. And one might say, well, how can you say that's the real reason? If you look at the research, which I've included in the book, it is documented that there wasn't very much impressment whatever. It happened occasionally, but not a lot. But there was Congress and U.S. businesses were calling for war. They were calling for the conquest of Canada so that their businesses could flourish.
In fact, there was quite a lot of opinion to the effect that the Canadians would welcome American flags with flowers and chocolate. It reminds me of the invasion of Iraq 10 years ago and numerous other ones. I mean, there was this belief, was there not, that on in certain quarters in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, that Canada would welcome U.S. troops as liberators.
And that is a theme that continues throughout U.S. history. the idea that U.S. exceptionalism, that everyone wants to be like the U.S., manifest destiny, that the U.S. Is somehow divinely inspired or divinely granted permission to take over whatever area of the world it wants. And this idea of the liberators, I remember then Vice President Dick Cheney saying that Iraqis would strew flower petals in front of U.S. soldiers. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. And that's been true with every war since the beginning. The atrocities that the U.S. soldiers have committed are not something that are going to stimulate the populace to welcome them.
We are running out of time, but quickly, Bob Fantina, you are the author of Desertion and the American Soldier, of Look Not Unto the Morrow, and of this new history, Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. We've just been talking about Canada, and we've lost you to Canada, one of our good citizens, thinkers, writers. You've deserted us and moved to Canada. How did that happen?
Well, thank you for the compliment. Right after the 2004 presidential election, well, I should go back a little bit. In 2000, of course, George Bush lost the election, but was appointed president by the Supreme Court. I never thought he would be actually legitimately elected, and whether or not he was, I don't know, but in 2004, he was elected. It seemed he did get the majority vote. And the day after that, I decided with my family that we needed to leave the country.
If you squint really hard when you look at Ohio and a few other states, let's say.
Oh, I try not to. Ohio certainly was, to say that the voting there, or the count, the voting count was honest, is just a ridiculous statement. So yes, I don't believe that he was legitimately elected. But either way, we have moved to Canada, and there is much here that we like. It's a less violent society. I certainly have criticisms of it, but we are not sorry. I shouldn't speak for my wife and my son, but I'm not sorry that I no longer live in the United States. It's so polarized. It is violent. My tax dollars, when I lived there, went to atrocities that I wanted no part of, and I am no part. I'm no part of them now, at least living in Canada.
Was it the general worsening trend of militarism and materialism and racism and violence that seems not to have halted with the departure of George W. Bush, or was it really that election? Do you place a lot of importance on elections?
Well, the election was the catalyst. It was kind of my recognition that things aren't going to get better, that the racism that we see so prevalent in the United States, that blatant and rampant imperialism was just too much, and I just thought, I can't be a part of this anymore. But no, as you said, little has changed in the last 5 years, and it doesn't look like there will be much change anytime in the future.
We've been speaking with Robert Fantina. His latest book is Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. We'll have all of his books linked from Talk Nation Radio's website. Bob, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.